This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
So it's easy to see Joseph Smith going into Nauvoo in a sense of hurried urgency to accomplish a great deal. You have to wonder then, was he always concerned about the forebodings of death? Was he morose? Was he melancholy? Joseph, that was not in his bones.
Coming up next, the climax of Nauvoo, Part 2.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
As 1844 opened in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith was a man of considerable influence and power. Now, while his enemies feared him because of that power, it was the Mormon leader's intent to use all the influence he could garner for the good and the blessing of his people. So accordingly, January 1844, Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, allowed his name to be put forward as a candidate for president of the United States.
James B. Allen.
I think we have to remember that one of the reasons that Joseph Smith had so much to say at times about American politics is because Joseph Smith was a patriot. He was a lover of America. Joseph Smith believed that the Constitution was divinely inspired. He believed, with the Book of Mormon, of course, that there was a great destiny for America. And he looked forward to establishing the kingdom of God in America. In fact, in his mind, that's what the church was for, was to prepare America and the world for the establishment of the kingdom of God.
Ronald O. Barney.
George Washington Taggart typifies, probably, and represents the sentiment that people who lived in Nauvoo felt when they heard Joseph Smith speak on political themes. In a letter that he wrote to his brothers, who stayed behind in southern New Hampshire after his emigration to Nauvoo in 1843, he wrote, "He is one of the warmest patriots and friends to his country and laws that you ever heard speak on the subject."
Joseph Smith's decision to run for president of the United States was not a sudden thing. Those events that brought him to announce his candidacy, well, they began as early as 1833 in Missouri.
It's probably worthwhile to remember that Joseph Smith's candidacy for the presidency of the United States did not begin in 1844. Obviously, he had been disappointed by government inaction and the inability to get the difficulties that had been laid upon the saints before the American populace, and that they had been deprived of their rights.
Mark Ashurst McGee.
Now, as is well known, the saints are driven out of Jackson County. And when Joseph Smith hears about this happening in December of 1833, he, of course, goes to the Lord to try to get revelation on this problem. And he receives a revelation on the 16th of December, 1833, on the subject of the redemption of Zion.
Well, this is the background then of section 101 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Joseph believed that this was a land of liberty, and for his people not to be able to go back to Missouri or go back to Jackson County, simply didn't give them the liberty that he thought the Constitution guaranteed them. Their constitutional rights, in his mind, were not being enforced.
And these are the deep roots of what eventually causes him to run for president.
The saints were commanded in a revelation to seek redress from the various levels of government, from the state all the way up to the federal. The state of Missouri refused to help them. So while a prisoner in Liberty Jail, Joseph Smith instructed the saints to prepare to seek redress from Washington.
In this letter on March 25th, 1839, he extolled the Constitution. He called it a glorious standard, a heavenly banner. And he lamented the fact that the Mormons were being deprived of the blessings that it had promised, or at least in his mind, that it had promised. But at the same time, he was planning what you might call a new assault on the nation's capital, a propaganda assault. He was planning to either go himself or send somebody to Washington, D.C., to try to bring before Congress and the president the real situation of the saints.
He writes his March 1839 letter to the saints and instructs them to gather up all, to make accounts of all the things that have happened to them, to make out bills of damage for the property that they've lost, and to collect all of this material, which he will take to Washington, D.C., and lay before President of the United States. Joseph Smith said, this is the last thing that's required of us before we can take our case directly to the Lord.
As we've seen, United States President Martin Van Buren refused to help them. Your cause is just, he said, but I can do nothing for you. Well, with that, it seemed to Joseph Smith and his people that all avenues for redress that had been commanded in Section 101 of the Doctrine and Covenants were finally closed. They had done all that they could do.
But then when he says, if I were to help you, I would come in contact with the state of Missouri, or I would lose the votes of the state of Missouri, in effect, it's opening the door back up again, because maybe the president of the United States will help them, just not this president.
The next presidential candidate was William Henry Harrison, a Whig, who, after only a few weeks in office, died in April of 1841. The presidency was then assumed by John Tyler, a Democrat, and he was of no help to the Mormons. So they were left waiting for the presidential election of 1844.
So in November of 1843, they send out these letters to all the major candidates and say, if basically, in effect, if we were to throw our votes behind you and help you be elected, if you were elected, what would you do to help our cause? What would you do to help the Mormon people? And of the responses that Joseph Smith and Mormon leaders do get back, they are not satisfied.
Well, Joseph Smith then is going to call for a change. In spite of his strong constitutional feelings, Joseph Smith was a realist, and he finally recognized that more than ever how far his views of the Constitution were different from other people's views.
There's no one who really pledges to defend the cause of the Mormons. And it is for this reason that Joseph Smith decides to run for president.
By the end of January 1844, Joseph Smith had very clearly made the determination that he was going to insert himself into the discussion about rights, about laws, about how a beleaguered people should be treated in a land of liberty.
Under Joseph Smith's direction, W.W. Phelps, a printer, was assigned by the candidate to put his unique political platform into writing.
This platform, which W.W. Phelps was assigned to write, ended up being the very important 8-page pamphlet entitled General Smith's Views of the Powers and Policy of the Government of the United States.
But after that was read in public in Nauvoo, he stood up and he said, I would not have suffered my name to have been used by my friends on any wise as President of the United States or candidate for that office if I and my friends could have had the privilege of enjoying our religious and civil rights as American citizens, even those rights which the Constitution guarantees unto all her citizens alike. But this, as a people, we have been denied from the beginning. But so far as Joseph Smith's platform was concerned, here are some of the issues that he was concerned with. One, government and economic reform. He actually wanted to reduce the size of Congress and to reduce their pay. And I thought they'd do a better job that way. And he wanted a Bank of the United States that had once been destroyed by Andrew Jackson and other things that he thought would bring greater economic stability and also reform in the kind of government that he witnessed when he went to Washington in 1840 and saw some things that he wasn't happy with. Another thing that he called for was prison reform. And that was very much on the minds of people of the day. They were beginning to look at prisons and see how terrible people were treated in prisons. And a number of societies had been formed to try to reform the prisons. And he made his own statements which were a little more far-reaching. He wanted to let everybody go and then start all over again with better prisons. And he wanted to make the prisons temples of learning, so to speak. They ought to teach rather than just punish. And that was very progressive for his days. He was opposed to slavery. Although he did not call for the federal government to eliminate slavery, he did call for the state legislatures to eliminate slavery in the states and to raise money to pay the slave owners for the value of their slaves.
There were other significant issues that were addressed in the pamphlet. Joseph Smith was not the typical candidate politician of the day. His views were fresh and they resonated with people. Also, campaigns back then, they were not run the same then as they are now.
Today, where it's the case that, and many of us have become quite familiar with it, that the run for the presidency becomes an occupation in itself, highly visible. The candidate cannot find enough venues wherein they would display and portray their ideas, their sentiments, their strategies before the American public. It was just not that way in the 19th century in antebellum America. There was a reticence on the part of candidates to appear over-anxious about assuming such a lofty and magisterial position. They allowed others to advance their names, their reputations for them. Joseph Smith then did not immediately go on the campaign trail. Indeed, some may find it hard to see evidence of his own involvement in a presidential run.
Joseph Smith sends a large missionary force throughout the United States to campaign for his presidency. And this missionary force is led by the 12 apostles. The 12 apostles are not in Nauvoo. They're out in the field supervising over 300 missionaries campaigning for Joseph Smith's presidency. Joseph Smith is by no means just another candidate. All of the major candidates in the election of 1844 are kind of your traditional politician. And here comes Joseph Smith, and in his views, which he publishes and distributes, he weighs in on some of these major issues for the day. Not orthodox at all. He is his own candidate, as Richard Bushman puts it. He has interesting ideas that really fall out of the normal political molds of the day for ideologies and party positions. He really breaks the mold.
Of course, there were a number of other important matters that drew Joseph Smith's attention during this time. It was in March of 1844, during the campaign, that there was created the final institution of church government organized in Joseph Smith's lifetime. It was called the Council of 50.
There was a political undertone to this organization. In many ways, it was civic in its intent. It was organizational. It was meant to create an atmosphere of cooperation and understanding. There was, from all that we gather, nothing nefarious about it. And there was underlying this the anticipation of Jesus' return to the earth in the last days, and that there needed to be an apparatus available for him to properly take his role as the king of the earth.
The Council of 50 played a concrete role in several interesting episodes. They were involved in the election of 1844 when Joseph Smith ran as president. They played a role in the exodus from Nauvoo in 1845 and 1846 in preparing for that great trek. And they played a role providing a framework of government in early Utah in 1849 and 50 before the territory of Utah was organized. But for the most part, it was symbolic and of great symbolic importance as a model of how priesthood government could work in a theocracy so that priesthood leaders and other good men, again, three non-members were members of the First Council under Joseph Smith, would govern the earth according to Christ's principles and under his direction when he should return. Now, it was secret because you probably don't announce that we're an incipient organization that will take over the world with prophets, priests, and kings under Christ. Because Joseph Smith's pronouncements encompassed a role for the church in all the world, and these were public pronouncements, religiously, sometimes with political implications, people did fear that he intended to be another Muhammad coming out of the desert with his hordes. And he, in fact, made very clear that indeed we will revolutionize the world, but not by fire and sword. We'll do it by the principles of the gospel and the power of the Lord Jesus Christ, and not by the arm of man.
Also in the early months of 1844, Joseph Smith gathered the 12 apostles close to him, and in a series of meetings, he taught them and prepared them to succeed him. And then, just before they left to campaign for Joseph Smith for president, he delivered to them what turned out to be his last charge.
What he did at this dramatic meeting, which none of them ever forgot, and which some of them talked about until their death, for example, Wilford Woodruff in the 1880s and 90s in Utah, was that he was tired of carrying the burden of the kingdom alone. It was now their responsibility. I roll the burden of the kingdom onto your shoulders, and I will rest a while. And they talk about him dancing around as a free man. Parley Pratt, a few months after Joseph Smith's death, published a statement publicly about this meeting. And in this statement, he says, after Joseph Smith made this proclamation and indicated to all of those in attendance that he intended now to rest, he did one other thing. He gave the final key, which pertains only to the first presidency in Parley Pratt's language, to Brigham Young and to the apostles. Now, the theology suggests that the apostles held all the keys that Joseph did when he ordained them, when he participated in their ordination in Kirtland. But in fact, Joseph Smith received additional keys in the Kirtland Temple in the spring of 1836. They did not hold those keys until late March of 1844 at the last charge when he passed those keys on to them. Now, indeed, they were fully empowered. They were experienced. They had responsibilities that the saints understood. They had the confidence of the saints, and he could rest for a while. Only a matter of a week after that meeting, less than 2 weeks, he sends the 12 away from Nauvoo. By the time they return, Joseph Smith is dead.
As the prophet's ministry drew to a close, there were several important things that were happening. First of all, Joseph Smith's notoriety had extended far beyond the Mississippi River Valley because of his campaign for the presidency. Second of all, back at home in Hancock County, tension, animosity, even hatred had neared a fevered pitch among some Hancock County residents. And then lastly, within the church itself, there were apostates, dissidents, who were scheming to bring Joseph Smith down. Their intention was to use the April 1844 General Conference of the Church as a forum to air their grievances.
Kenneth W. Godfrey
thought they would raise the issue that Joseph was a fallen prophet because he wasn't receiving revelation at the same speed that he'd been receiving it back in Kirtland when almost every week there'd be a new revelation, or maybe even more often than that. And so they thought they would perhaps could debate this issue a bit from the conference floor. And then they also had in their minds they would raise this, his practice of plural marriage, which was not common knowledge amongst all of the saints in Nauvoo, but was there were some that were aware that this was going on, and that perhaps there would be such an outpouring of resentment against the practice of plural marriage that this would help bring down the prophet. And William Law was serving as the prophet's second counselor in the first presidency of the church. Sidney Rigdon wasn't always in good standing with the prophet, and so this might give William Law, some think, an opportunity to become the leader of the church. Well, Joseph Smith, in a great display of leadership, opens this conference by saying that the purpose, a prophet's purpose, is to receive revelation and give guidance and direction to the church through revelation, and that before this conference is over, he will give a new revelation. And then he calls on Sidney Rigdon.
Sidney Rigdon, as Joseph Smith's counselor, had once played a very public role in the church, but Liberty Jail changed all that. After that experience, some say that it broke not only his health, but his spirit.
So in Nauvoo, because of bad health, because he's out of sorts with some of the program, he's very much in the background, and you don't see Sidney for months at a time in a public role. He does emerge just before the martyrdom in the last general conference. In fact, he generally monopolizes the 6th April 1844 general conference, morning session and afternoon, I believe. And he did it in a very dramatic fashion. It was the old Sidney, the great orator, who could hold an audience spellbound. And he talked and reminisced with the saints about those early days in a sense that conveyed, I was there, I knew. Back then when we were such a small group, the whole priesthood of the church could fit in a small cabin. And yet we dreamed such grand dreams, and only now can they be told. And then he told his vision of the grand future. In a sense, one can see this in retrospect as a coming out party, as if he were saying, I understand Joseph Smith may not be with us very long, and when he's gone, I'm your man.
After Sidney had finished speaking, and then in response to Sidney, Joseph Smith took the stand and preached what some consider to be his greatest public sermon ever.
It was the King Follett's Discourse of the 7th of April, 1844. As if to say, and again this is my interpretation, you listened to Sidney yesterday. Sidney's a grand pioneer of the Restoration. But let me tell you, there is a prophet in Israel still. And then he talked about the true nature of God and the true relationship of man to God and how we are of God's race. And our potential is to become with him, like him, among him. And I think anybody who saw both of those sermons would have realized, we love Brother Sidney for all he's done, but Joseph is our prophet. And Sidney receded immediately back to the background. You don't see him again giving public sermons or really having a public role that gets recorded in the records.
You may remember that this great conference sermon that Joseph preached at this time was also the funeral sermon for Elder King Follett, who had once been, along with Parley P. Pratt, a prisoner in Missouri in 1839.
Gordon A. Madsen.
He then, with Parley, filed a motion for a change of venue on the ground they could get a fair and impartial trial in Richmond, Ray County, and the cases were transferred to Boone County, Columbia, the county seat. in Columbia, Parley and his associates, Morris Phelps, and King Follett, on the 4th of July, declared their own independence, as they called it, and escaped the jail. But Follett, being an older man, could not run as fast as Parley and Morris, and was rearrested, taken back to the jail, and he alone, the following September, is tried. So he's the only one of all of the named defendants who actually has a trial in front of a Missouri jury there in Columbia. Following his acquittal, King Follett moves to Illinois and joins the Saints in Nauvoo. We don't know the date of his arrival, but he was the last of all of those originally charged by Judge King. Thereafter, working in Nauvoo on the Nauvoo Temple, King Follett is crushed by a tipping bucket of stone that buried him, and Joseph preaches his funeral sermon. We read the sermon and its import. It's called the King Follett Sermon, probably the most sophisticated theological sermon Joseph ever gives, of which we have record. We think of it in terms of what he explains about the nature of God, and we forget that he is preaching at the funeral of a dear friend, one who spent time in chains with him in Richmond jail. We forget that what he is describing about God and the hereafter is what he is saying about what King Follett has to look forward to.
It was not all doom and gloom for Joseph Smith in late Nauvoo. Notwithstanding the fact that his enemies were applying increasing pressure on him, and the fact that he had presentiments of his own death, those last few months in Nauvoo for Joseph Smith, they were the capstone of his ministry.
If Nauvoo was a temple city, it's not surprising that one of his highest priorities from the time that he introduced the endowment in May of 1842 until his death was to do with the temple. So we see Joseph Smith involved in temple ordinance work throughout 1843, when the women are first involved, beginning in September, and from that point until his death, he's organizing a group of men and women who get teachings from him related to the temple, and he did that private teaching throughout the months before the martyrdom, sufficiently that at his death, we had approximately 70, some nearly three dozen women prepared, instructed, endowed, ready to officiate in the temple when the temple was finished for the rest of the saints.
By May of 1844, Joseph Smith's enemies were more organized and vocal than they had ever been. They were a genuine, palpable threat.
And Joseph was not totally oblivious to all this. Nonetheless, the record does not show a man who's long in the mouth. It shows a man who knows who he is, who says to the saints from the pulpit, "I'm as close to God as ever I was," and who's willing now to go forward at whatever cost to do the rest that he can do while he's here, even though he knew that time may be somewhat limited, and in fact was.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram Smith. I'm Glenn Rossin. Thanks for joining.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.